accession number 19858, reel 2.
Major French, reel 2.
The commanding officer asked me why I wasn't engaging the enemy. I said because we hadn't seen any enemy. And so this battle, whatever, went on for maybe 3 or 4 hours during the night. And next morning, there were quite a number of dead cats, I think, wild cats and foxes, which had all been slaughtered on the wild in front of D Company's position. And it was certainly a proof that there had been no enemy out that night at all. The commanding officer was very good at coming around all the positions at first light every morning, said, well, in fact, you know, you were quite right, the way you played it, but from battalion headquarters way back, it seemed very strange that there was a battle going on and you were taking no part in it. But in fact, I think I got a good mark for that.
How uncomfortable were you all in the front line?
Well, we weren't uncomfortable because we were living in positions that, of course, been prepared and improved over the previous year or whatever since it became a static war. And so the command posts were usually pre-constructed by the Royal Engineers and put in. And so although this was, of course, in the late summer, it was very hot and sticky then. Later, of course, came the winter when it did get extremely cold, down to, I think, minus 25 degrees centigrade or something like that. But we were never really uncomfortable because we made ourselves comfortable. There were beds of a sort that were constructed from pickets and signal wire, and I suppose we had sleeping bags. I don't actually remember it, but we must have had sleeping bags. And of course we had far better clothing, warm clothing. Much of it, I think, was probably American. String vests, parkas, and things like that. And so we were able to live in comparative comfort. And one remembers the sort of smell of the dugout, and the smell of sand, the smell of cooking, the smell of the earth. We had the chuffas, which were dripping petrol onto a tin, and the chimney coming out of the top of the dugout. And so we were able to keep pretty warm and snug in those conditions. Obviously, when one was going out on patrol, I didn't go on many patrols because I was really the equivalent of a small company commander rather than a platoon commander. So I had under me, I think it was 4 or 6 corporals, each commanding maybe about 15 men. And so most of the patrols were led by the corporals, and I would stay back. The main trouble, I think, with the patrolling, particularly at that stage, there was always the danger if one, I mean, obviously we did patrols as ordered by battalion headquarters, but if one went out on the same route each night or came back on the same route, the Chinese, who were, of course, far better at fieldcraft and knowing the country and having been brought up as completely rural people, they would be very good at ambushing you. So we had to be careful of that. And, of course, the other problem was the minefields. These were our own minefields, of course, in front of our position. And although they were marked with the normal mine markers, shelling and so on, enemy shelling, would often knock down the thing. And so you could easily stumble into a minefield. And, in fact, quite soon on, there was one of my fusiliers was actually killed in a minefield, and he was the first casualty we had. there was also in the valley, for some extraordinary reason, there was a small Korean family who seemed to be living in a hut somewhere in the middle of no man's land. And they were always rather a puzzle to us. Well, I think anyway, eventually they just disappeared. So that was them. What should we go on with now?
Did you suspect that they might be working for the enemy?
There was always this problem. You see, we employed, every battalion did, a large number of Korean porters. And they were called the gooks. There wasn't, in fact, a derogatory term at all, because in Korean language, gook means people. And they were very cheerful lot. And if you met them, and they were, of course, the porters bringing the stores and ammunition and everything up to the positions where vehicles couldn't go. And you met one old Korean leading his lot up, and you said, you know, good morning, Papa-san, how are you? You know, and his eyes would twinkle, and he'd give you a very smart salute. And they were a marvelous lot. And some of the younger ones, who were only boys, I suppose, about 12, 14, something like that, and orphans, they used to attach themselves to platoons and companies. I mean, my batman even had, as his batman, so to speak, a 14-year-old Korean boy. And, of course, they were marvelous because they were sensible enough to understand that, you know, we'd come over really to protect their country of South Korea. And there was nothing they wouldn't do, say, any of the sort of more menial tasks that a fusilier might, in normal circumstances, have had to tackle. You know, he'd get these Korean boys, you know, go and cook the officer's breakfast or something when he comes back from going around the position, things like that. So they were great people.
What was your own particular unit equipped with?
We had in support company, of which I was technically a part, there was the mortar platoon with 3-inch mortars. There was the machine gun platoon. I can't remember the caliber of the machine gun platoon, but anyway, both of those platoons in the company were still, of course, operating in their proper role, as opposed to my anti-tank platoon, who, I said earlier, were infantrymen. The rest of the battalion was, of course, in A, B, C, D company, and they had the normal rifles. Awful, though, I can't remember. You see, it wasn't the 7.62 that had come in then, but said, well, I think it was something after the 303 rifle, but awfully, I can't remember. But most of us, in fact, were armed with submachine guns, and then, of course, we had the 36 grenade, phosphorus grenade, and things like that. And then in the signal platoon, which I later came to command, we had the 88 set, and that was the 88A and the 88B. The 88A was the platoon radio, and we had a lot of those, so very often one could actually put an 88 set right down to section level, and of course all the patrols that went out had the 88 set working back. Then from the company headquarters back to battalion headquarters, we had a thing called the 31 set, and of course one had to get the aerials up, because being in such mountainous country, you know, one had to make sure one could get through on the air. But we didn't use the radios all that much, except when the line, that's the telephone line, went out, then one had to rely on radio. But we did have to conserve the batteries of the 88 sets and the 31 sets, and at one stage some of these batteries were in very short supply. I don't know what the problem was way back in the War Office, but we had to conserve the radios. We also had the 62 set, which worked back from battalion to brigade headquarters. So a lot of the communication was in fact by telephone. And when I took over the signal platoon, which was about 4 months later, we had to rely on these telephones and the line, and there were the most marvelous telephone exchanges at every level, so that you could talk virtually to anybody, back to brigade headquarters, to the flanking units, to the New Zealand gunners, who were the most marvelous lot and could react immediately if you wanted to call down fire. But one of the trouble, of course, about the telephone lines, and although we buried the line wherever possible, where there was likelihood of shelling, they were very often going out when they were either, you know, driven over by some vehicle, but more likely from enemy shelling. So one had to have line parties, which I used to go with them whenever I could, after heavy shelling, to repair the line, because the communications were, of course, absolutely vital. But that is really jumping on a bit, because that is, because I had one other job between the half company I was commanding and the and becoming signals officer, and that was I was second in command of C Company. I only did that for about 2 months. That was quite interesting, but it wasn't really a job that I much enjoyed, and one used to go up every night to see one's company commander and spend about maybe 2 or 3 hours with him. He was a chap who'd been the commanders during the war. He was, of course, a Royal Fusilier. He was called Terry Donnelly, and he later became, well after career, commanding officer of the battalion. And one used to sit with him in the command post, having the odd drink of whiskey, and really keeping him company until maybe about midnight or something like that. Then I would go back to F.A. Schnorr, which was, I suppose, 2 or 3 miles behind the line, and spend the rest of the night there. But basically, as company second in command, one was responsible for all the administrative side of keeping the company in the line, supplied with all the things they needed. I always used to make a point, when going back, of calling into the regimental sergeant major, who was a marvelous, huge man called Paddy Duran, who was a great friend of mine. And he and the PT sergeant lived in a bunker near battalion headquarters. And he was, of course, the man responsible for the battalion ammunition. So it was always nice to go in and have a chat with him, and then go back to F.A. Schlom. But I only did that job for, I suppose it was a couple of months or something like that. And then in the new year, I became the signals officer. Now, there had, in fact, been before me two other signals officers, partly because the battalion being new out there and not knowing the form and everything, communications had not been as good as the commanding officer wanted. And of course, as I said, communications were absolutely vital for passing of information and calling for fire support and so on. So both these retired signal officers had been sacked one after the other, and I was put in the third one as the third one. And I think there were the odd bets placed as to how long I would last. Well, I was, in fact, I think, lucky in a way, because I had not done a signal officer's course at Hythe, because before we went out, of course, no one was going to be a signals officer. There was no question of going the whole way back to England to learn the trade. I had a very good Sergeant Hill, who was my platoon's signal platoon sergeant. He had done the courses, and he was very good at the technical side of signalling. My main thing, really, was to keep in touch with all the, I think I had 110 men under my command in the signal platoon. By this time, I was just about to turn 23 or something like that. And so these signalers were everywhere. They were back with the quartermaster at a B echelon. They were in A echelon. They were in F echelon. Very large number were, of course, at battalion headquarters, the commanding officer's headquarters. And then there were signalers out in the company as well. And, of course, they, in an operational sense, were under their company commander, who they were working with. But they were actually men of my platoon, so I made a point every day of getting around everywhere in my, wasn't Land Rover, I suppose it was a Jeep. There were some Land Rovers, but I think I must have had a Jeep, or, of course, going forward on foot. And the great thing about that is having one's men in such a large parish, one was able not only to go and see them, but one was also able to go and see one's friends in all the company positions, i.e. the platoon commanders who were my age and things like that. And so one did know, one was able to keep very closely in touch with what was going on. Then, as being part of battalion headquarters as the signals officer, one used to do one's tour of duty at night in the command post on the telephones and radios there, so that the commanding officer and the battle adjutant and people like that could, you know, have a bit of sleep as well. Although on the whole, people mainly slept by day, because nearly all the operations and the patrolling of that was done at night. And of course, my fear, particularly being in the battalion command post at night, was not a fear of the shelling or something like that, because one was well dug in, and one really, quite honestly, got fairly used to it. But my fear was the communications going out, because then everybody would look. Bloody signals officer, you know, why the hell can't we get through to A Company on the blower? And so one always felt this tremendous responsibility for the communications of the battalion.
What kind of terrain were you in?
Well, if I can just talk briefly about what I thought of the country itself. The terrain, of course, that we were in, we were, as I say, on the Samichon Valley, and everything was dominated by the hills. And, you know, not for nothing is Korea known as the land of the morning calm. And you used to see these vast great hills appearing out of the mist in the mornings. And it was, you know, a magnificent sight. And, I mean, I found that Korea was actually a very beautiful country. Of course, where we were in the static line right across the front of living in trenches and living like troglodytes or something like that, it was completely devastated and, you know, wasted land. But when one went further back, one was able to really appreciate how incredibly peaceful and beautiful the country was. And if one had a day off or something like that, one would wander up these tiny little valleys. You used to see the most gorgeous, sparkling streams, and one used to bathe and wash in those. One used to see pheasants. I had with me out there my 12-bore, and I used to take that sometimes on a day off to try and shoot the odd pheasant. I don't think I ever did actually shoot any, but there were pheasant and duck around. And then one would see little temples, icons and things like that, statues to their gods, Buddhists, I suppose. On the hillside, one would sometimes stumble across a little village, and one would see the people there trying to, almost as if the war didn't exist, eke out their life as farmers. And one used to see them in the paddy fields with their marvelous sort of pointed top hats working there. And one didn't, of course, have much communication with them, apart from the fact you couldn't speak the language, and also there wasn't much time. But I just do remember incredibly peaceful atmosphere in that area. And this is, I mean, probably 20 miles behind the line. One also, of course, got great memories of the pretty awful smell of the countryside, because all their manure was either human or animal manure. And I suppose one got used to it, and one didn't have to, you know, spend much time in it. But that there is a definite memory of the sort of smell of the Korean countryside. But I do remember it being, you know, a very beautiful land, and terribly sad, of course. I mean, we weren't there at the time when the refugees were streaming back, but when one ever went right back to Seoul, you know, it was absolutely devastated after the fighting that had gone on there the year before in the 1551.
Now, can we please go back to the chronology, because you were saying that you had had your first spell in the front line. Is it possible to take the chronology on from there, please?
Yes. After we... one used to normally, I think, spend about 4 or 6 weeks in the line, and then one might go out of the line. This is as the battalion, as opposed to the division, of course. The division didn't come out of the line as a complete division until the spring of 53, although January, February 53. But I took my platoon then out of the line, and I think it was soon after that, in the autumn of 53, when I went across to C Company. And when we were out of the line, one used to, of course, do quite a lot of training and putting right the faults that people had found and so on. And then I went with C Company when we took over, and I think we took over from a Royal Australian Regiment battalion, and so we had to move up in trucks to the front line. And of course, the procedures of taking over in the line were very well rehearsed. But I did find that the Canadians, although they were jolly good soldiers, they were rather a sort of rough lot, and they didn't mind, I don't know, making a noise at night. Or the Canadians, who we sometimes saw, they used to even smoke in the front line. And then, of course, they were picked off by snipers, and they were lighting up their fags, I suppose. But anyway, I helped the C Company move into the line. And then while there in November that year, that was November 52, we had the Battle of Pimlico. Now, I won't really go into this much, because it was not my company, C Company, that was involved. It was D Company. Would you like me to say a few words about Pimlico, or is this so well recorded anyway?
No, I'd like it if you would, please.
Right, well, the idea of Pimlico was to have a company-sized raid on the Chinese opposite us. And this was when we were on Hill 355, I think. And the idea mainly was take a prisoner, because it wasn't very easy to take prisoners in those days. The planning was done in great secrecy and on a need-to-know basis. because there was always the fear of the enemy discovering what was going on. So the planning was really left to a commanding officer and Mike Charge's D Company. But I do remember, something was afoot, but not the details of it. But I do remember about 2 or 3 days before, the Corps commander, who was an American general, came down in his helicopter to battalion headquarters and landed there. Well, this was the first time that a helicopter had ever, other than evacuating casualties, the first time that an American general arrived by helicopter. And the Chinese, not stupid, I mean, they could see from their positions that something was going on. The rehearsals that the platoons had to do for Operation Pimlico had been going on for about a week before, and they'd been going on out of the line on the hills, but really, I think, probably within view of the Chinese. Then, of course, there were all the porters, who I talked about earlier, the Goose. And I'm certain other people would know more about this than me, that amongst them were Koreans who were able, in one way or another, to communicate with the Chinese as to what was going on. Anyway, there were 3 platoons involved. One was commanded by my best friend, who is called Kit Hoare, and he was a young second lieutenant who, like myself, was a Catholic. He'd been educated at Stonyhurst. I shared a cabin with him on the way out, with some others as well. And Kit Hoare, he was a very cheerful, amusing bloke, was always sort of full of pranks and things, but he used to say, "I know that I will not survive. I know I'll be killed." And we used to say, "Oh, absolute rubbish." And the other platoon commander was, strangely enough, another Catholic called Peter de Roper. I can't remember who the 3rd platoon commander was, but they were all given their various tasks on Pimlico, and they set out after last light on whatever the date was, the end of November 52. And the idea was to go through our lines, I think, and to form a firm base. And then Peter de Roper's platoon were going to pass through that and attack the Chinese trenches and try and bring back a prisoner. But in fact, the whole thing went completely wrong, because either completely fortuitous, or more likely, I think, because Chinese knew that something was afoot, they were completely outnumbered, the platoons of D Company. And they, fairly soon on, met with tremendous opposition. I mean, probably about 200 or 300 Chinese ambushed them. And the battle then, and one could call it a battle, went on all that night. Kit Hoare was killed. He was badly wounded, and then he was killed. Peter de Roper and his platoon, we thought Peter had been killed. There was a fusilier, George Hodgkinson, and he was the radio operator with Kit Hoare's platoon. He survived, although he was taken prisoner, and he was absolutely marvelous, because when all